I think after that you will see why I don't try to read. Almost a feeling that anything I say will be anticlimactic. I want to say I first met William Gass about 16 or 17 years ago at one of these plagues they call writers' conferences, where we were a group of people, this was in Sarasota, had come to learn the secrets of writing, I think mainly for the Saturday Evening Post or something like that. And one lady of a certain age asked Bill that one of the worst questions, why do you write, Mr. Gass? And Gass, beaming as always, said, I write out of outrage. I write out of fury. I write for revenge. And this poor woman was absolutely floored. And she had hoped for some formula to sell a story to Red Book, and she did not get it. At any rate, what he said about the earlier, about this cult meeting, I did have a feeling with the recognitions that there were, from my sales figures, about 12 copies being passed from hand to hand all across the country. I did hear from a boy who had been in Turkish prison for drugs, of course, that there was a copy there being passed around. And I thought, this is, for one's readership, this is quite a start. I did say in the recognitions, which I wrote, this is 40 years ago, this whole business of giving readings and so forth, which I've always tried to avoid, because I've always felt that it turns the atmosphere is one which tries to turn the creative artist into a performing artist. And this has become more and more true in the last 40 years, so that now it seems everything is performance. And if you are not a performer, you are obliged to be put into a performing position. But at that time, in the recognitions, the painter who becomes the forger, the central figure in the book, has a wife who is very much goes to literary things and goes to meet the latest poet and the readings and so forth, because they were going on even then up to a point. And he says to her, this passion for wanting to meet the latest poet, shake hands with the latest novelist, get hold of the latest painter, devour, what is it? What is it they want from a man that they didn't get from his work? What do they expect? What is there left of him when he's done his work? What's any artist but the dregs of his work? The human shambles that follows it around. And that's pretty much the way I still look at it 40 years later, following it around now all the way to St. Louis. I was told that I could say whatever, talk about whatever I wanted to for this keynote talk, about largely getting to the recognitions and the theme of this conference involving religion and the writer. The book, one thing that was awfully interesting when it came out, everything that Bill Gass said was true in the way of the critical attention. But something else that was awfully interesting, it was reviled as being negative and a dark view of our country and so forth and so forth. One reviewer suggested I have my mouth washed out with soap. And I look around me today and think, my God, they look back on that, it was like summer camp. I mean, what we're living with now, I don't know about you here, but New York is certainly no fun. One review, I liked a line which said, what is this book about? Mr. Gaddis doesn't say. That was pretty much the atmosphere that it came into. I've always felt that the content and style should be part of each other. And I think what put people off with that book was the format, the fragmented format. And the times, to me, the times were they were fragmented times in the late 40s and early 50s. JR is much more broken up and shattered. And my feeling again that the times are in the 70s were shattered, and it did predict Reaganomics, if you wish, for the real shattering everything. But in going back to the Reaganicians and thinking about the theme of this week, the work that's coming in, that religion does play a large shadowy part in the background of that novel. The title, The Reaganicians, is from a piece of work by the first Pope, Clement of Rome, it was, who wrote something called Reaganicians, which is attributed to him at any rate, and it supposedly is the story. It's a man seeking salvation and going up various blind paths, and works in the story of Simon Magus, and has been called the source for the Faust myth, which I got fascinated by at the age of 20, and largely tried to base the Reaganicians, my version, on. It was this work of Clement was called the first Christian novel, and I thought, at the age of 25, mine will be the last. In terms of background, just very briefly, my father's mother was German Catholic, and his family was Scotch-Irish. My mother's family were good Quakers from this part of the country. They're from the East, and then they came out here around before the Civil War. And then when they went back East, the Quaker faith did not fit too well there. So my mother went off into Episcopalian. That had some class and some elegance to it. The rest of them, some of them went to Christian Science, of which I'll have more to say tomorrow. I went off at boarding school when I was 5 years old in Connecticut, and was brought up very much in that realm of not puritanical and not harsh, but still that world of where honesty pays and bad deeds are punished, and you keep your word, you do your work, you don't waste. In effect, the Protestant ethic. And it was a world, the idea that the world was a safe place, though I think we all look back on those days as still believing that myth. At any rate, when I got into toward 20, I realized, like as Charles Dickens said, the world was a far messier place than I had expected to find it. And so I got onto all this negative thinking, if you like. If you recall, existentialism was very much going on, talked about in the late 40s. And that fit right in with this kind of despairing look at life. In a sense of desolation that I had, at least, after sort of banging around New York and working, I went to Central America and then to Spain, started my book there, and had a very romantic notion of desolation and of despair and so forth. And I won't say that I had a flirtation with Catholicism, but I was very taken as a totally self-centered young man, romantic, Sorrows of a Young Werther and all of that sort of thing. the whole idea of Spain, on the one hand the cathedrals, on the other hand the aesthetic quality of Philip II and the Escorial, all this I was just overwhelmed by. And I went in fact to a monastery in western Spain, thinking I would have this aesthetic opposed to aesthetic experience of the whole idea of a monastery. Of course, I got out there, and they were waiting for people just like me, with a very nice room with a bed with sheets and blankets, and very nice food, and nothing for the tourists, in effect, to remind them that somewhere down the hall there were actual monks in actual unheated cells. So even that romantic gesture of mine fell flat. I was not allowed to suffer. And about this time, reading The Golden Bough of Fraser, and wrote, that book is a kind of expose, I thought, at the time, things were fraudulent, that everything was a fraud. You get into a book like that, and everywhere you look, everything you see is a fraud, from sexual practices to religious to what have you. And I thought I'd made a great discovery and was telling the world, bringing this news. The world did not feel that way about it. I think one of the key lines in it, because I still had this notion of the idea of perfection of the absolute as being the most attractive way that our thoughts and minds and work could go. And the key line in the book is when the central figure says about forgery, he says, thank God there was the gold to forge. The gold in this case would be perfection. Even if we cannot attain it, we do our best with our finite equipment to approach it and embrace it. And also the message that comes through, I think, there, that the church, which I was romantically intrigued by, the Catholic Church, survives all the comic stories that have grown up in it and around it and so forth. I was amazed just a couple of years ago, a girl showed up in New York from Poland, which I frankly was not aware was a fiercely Catholic country until the Pope let me know that it serious business there. But she showed up at the door and with a bottle of vodka in one hand and a bunch of flowers in the other, and wanted to talk to me about the recognitions, and as a very pro-Catholic book. And I was startled, and still am. When I protested, she said, well, I think what you wrote, you weren't aware, really, of what you were writing. It is a very pro-religious and pro-Catholic book. Well, you can't argue with that, and I didn't try. But since then, that was then, and this is now, as they say, the whole realm of the absolute, this is where I think there's a great battle going on now between the fundamentalists of any sort and the secular world, between absolutes, which we have this great nostalgia for, as opposed to indeterminate, what I see as indeterminacy, as relative values, as contingent universe, as what I see around me, not a breakage. But there is, I think, still this fierce nostalgia for order and for absolutes and for eventually what is called life everlasting, and this whole realm of immortality, where I think a lot of the trouble comes from. I think obviously the one thing that we cannot conceive of and we cannot accept is our own death. We know death takes place all around us to other people. What was his name? Saroyan supposedly said, in his last days, I knew this was something that happened to other people, but I thought an exception might be made in my case. And I think this is a not uncommon feeling. Alan Harrington wrote a book called The Immortalist, in which he said, opening line is, death is an imposition on the human race and no longer acceptable. Well, this, I think, is the source of a great deal of faith, religion, what have you, that the idea of life after death and so forth. I've often thought that we, as writers, are always working in a very selfish way on what we're working on is our own immortality. And that our work, I mean, I'm talking about serious writing as opposed to entertainment, which is transient. And those of us who try to write books that may be permanent, that is what we are doing while other people are going to church and putting it in hands of all kinds of some untrustworthy people. And we do certainly, I think, if not envy, at least look kind of wide-eyed at people who do have complete faith. This brings one to the whole realm. I don't know if you're familiar with a book called Roll Jordan Roll by a man named Genovese about 15 years ago. The subtitle is The World the Slaves Made. And it's a fascinating thesis about the black slaves brought to America who were given Christianity, saddled with it very much, as an opiate by their masters, with all of these myths of there's a better place waiting for you. This world is travail and difficult, but we are all born equal in the sight of God. And what happened, wildly enough, was that they did take this seriously, that as unequal as they were on a plantation somewhere, they would eventually be equal in the sight of God, where they all expected really to end up. And I went last year, a woman who has worked for us for many years, and a true believer in the marvelous sense, a black woman from North Carolina, South Carolina. Her husband was killed in a car accident, and I went to the funeral, and everyone was so jubilant and talking about, the whole idea was that he's in a better place. And there was no kidding about it. I mean, this was very real. When someone asked his son, your father was such a fine man, and how, why would the Lord want to take him? Because there's so many people here who just shouldn't be here, drunks and thieves and all kinds of things. Why would the Lord want to take a fine man like your father? And this boy said, well, the Lord, he don't want to surround himself with a lot of drunks and thieves. He wants some good men around him. He wants some fine men like my father. And I thought, what a stunning thing to be able to embrace that. I cannot do it. At any rate, after, as we just had this, having thought with the recognitions, I'm going to break this news about forgery and fraud, and everyone will be overwhelmed by it. And they were less than overwhelmed. I did the same thing all again with J.R. 20 years later, thinking I want to expose and tell everyone that the business world of so-called free enterprise is a rather childish affair. That the greed is natural and unrestrained when it reaches the point, certainly that it did in the 80s after the book came out. I thought this would make me not $1 million, but at least get me back on my feet. This did not happen again. Though I've thought in the realm of reviewers that we've mentioned, a story that I heard, an anecdote about fox hunting. Someone says, well, how is it that the hounds, who are as maybe as fast as a fox, but they have much longer breathing capabilities, they have much more stamina and can keep going. How is it the fox always gets away? And the answer was, well, the hounds are running for their lunch and the fox is running for his life. And I put this in my own terms as the reviewers are running for their dinner and the writer is running for his life. And I still am on the run. At their mercy, though they've been a little more generous recently. At any rate, after J.R. was not the success that I hoped, worldly success, I was asked to come and teach at a college. And what the inevitable course in creative writing, which is nothing I ever want to try to do again. I think it's a scourge, frankly. They said, what else do you want to teach? And I came up with it. They said, anything you want. So it was a moment to come up with a course in failure. And so I gave a course in the theme of failure in American literature. And of course, the further you go into literature, you find that all literature is about failure eventually, all good literature. Back to the Greeks, and some of the books that I, on our reading list were, for instance, Moby Dick was one, and Sinclair the Jungle, Dreiser's Sister Carrie, Lewis, Sinclair Lewis's Babbitt, Hemingway all the way through, right down to The Old Man and the Sea, Death of a Salesman, The Bell Jar, all of these things are about, eventually, about failure. and I learned a great deal. Of course, in my class, I did not get the handsome young football players or the girls who were going to be cheerleaders. I got people who were looking ahead to failure as a pretty good possibility. But we did have some very interesting conversations. And I think they may even have got something out of it. Among the cards that I had there were the book from a man named Shoemaker called Small is Beautiful. He was an economist, quoting Lord Keynes in 1930, saying, the day may not be too far off when everybody will be rich, when we shall once more value ends above means and prefer the good to the useful. But beware, the time for this is not yet. For at least another 100 years, we must pretend to ourselves and to everyone that fair is foul and foul is fair. For foul is useful and fair is not. Avarice and usury and precaution must be our gods for a little longer still. Only they can lead us out of the tunnel of economic necessity into daylight. And this is certainly was the 80s. I almost think that if Ronald Reagan could read, he might have read my novel and got some suggestions from it. As Schumacher again, if human vices such as greed and envy are systematically cultivated, the inevitable result is nothing less than a collapse of the intelligence. A man driven by greed or envy loses the power of seeing things as they really are. And his very successes become failures. The GNP may rise rapidly, as measured by statisticians, but not as experienced by actual people who find themselves oppressed by increasing frustration, alienation, insecurity, and so forth. And this, to me, is the... what is it? It's the deficit. It's the savings and loan scandal from which the Bushes seem the only people who prospered. the Bush boy ought to be in prison? Not a bit. She writes a book by her dog that brings in $800,000. Millie's book. It doesn't make life easier for a serious writer. at any rate, these may just be personal prejudices that I have. Thank you. the whole realm of why we write, someone asked that at a conference, which I, the good line was, for whom do you write? And at this conference, which I don't frequent many of them, but this was group, including Gass and Donald Barthelme and Coover and all these, should we say, non-bestsellers, put it mildly. And Barthelme, though, probably the most bestseller among us, this person said, for whom do you write? And Donald said, I write for attractive, well-dressed people who have a good income. I said, it's the only answer to that exasperating question. But along the way, in terms of understanding and reviews and so forth, when I have talked about my work, made a point of my attempt to put the reader in a collaborative position, if you will, to give the material of the situation, the characters, and so forth, and for the reader to, in effect, fill in, to collaborate with me on creating the eventual work of art. I use the term loosely, perhaps. This does have risks, which often show up in, you cannot control in whose hands the book will fall. Here is a woman in our local newspaper on Long Island. I didn't think they would do this to me, but they did. This last book, which is largely, as Bill said, about the law, she says, along with his obsessions about inherited wealth as a driving motive in human behavior, and his fascination with law and lawyers as sources of evil, this is perfectly weird. But that is what she put in and what she took out. One of the characters who is meant to be a two-dimensional kind of sleazy real estate insurance salesman, you know, at the bottom, and he's talking about, he calls our society a cesspool of human greed. Well, of course, she gives me that line. She says that I think our society is a cesspool of human greed. In fact, I talked to a man, someone from Toronto, Canada radio station, who wanted to interview me. And he finally said, Mr. Gaddis, if you feel this way, the way that you seem to about America, have you thought of living in another country? And I said, but why would I want to do that? Here is this feast of everything that I find fascinating about what people will do, which is, after all, what novels are about. Also, there's this wretched woman says something here about... A Frolic of His Own covers enough ground to create five books as it attacks with wry humor the deep flaws in a society which is getting worse when it was supposed to be getting better. Who said it was supposed to be getting better? I haven't heard that since I was 4 years old in boarding school. Something even better here. You would have expected, yes, you would have expected that with age he might have grown a bit more mellow. Why would you expect that? This sort of thing that makes it worth keeping going just to see what you will provoke. there is a new book on this whole idea of using, trying to invite the reader, as it were, to collaborate with you. And my thesis had been that if the reader does bring something to the book, he takes something more away than if you watch a television. This is back to McLuhan and his theories about hot and cold media and so forth. That the hot media does everything for you, like the television sitcom. The cool medium demands more, and the cooler, the more it demands, and so forth. And in this vein, I'm afraid my work either provokes the kind of review I just gave you a little taste of there, or complete incomprehension. And as George Steiner said, there is a theory that it's impossible to write the completely unreadable book, but this really takes a talent. Mr. Gaddis has that talent. Now, interestingly enough, there's a new biography of Tolstoy by a man named A.N. Wilson. Not brand new, but recently, last 10 years or so. He's talking about Lawrence Stern, and he says, Stern's huge appeal as a writer, again to use a criterion of Henry James, was that he did not, strictly speaking, write at all. The high popularity of A Sentimental Journey in the last 40 years of the 18th century stemmed from its usability as a blueprint for romantic egotists. Stylistically, it could have been penned by some lecherous parish clerk. It arrives in your hands half-finished. The reader does the writer's work for him, finding in it virtues which the reader has put there himself, and therefore esteems much more highly than he would the virtues of another. Stern, not surprisingly, enjoys great popularity in the 20th century, with its mania for readers doing the work of writers and discovering their own text as they go along. Now, I think writers frequently are paranoid to some degree. I read that passage. I'm usually surprised when people don't know of my work at all. I'm also very surprised when they do. This man, I think, must, because it's exactly what I've been working at. But it never occurred to me that someone would look at it as the reader is doing my work for me. I mean, one could certainly fill in all kinds of descriptions and adjectives and what have you, but I try to get things down to the bone so that the reader then can supply a good deal of this himself and form his own picture and in effect make the thing happen rather than being told as a four-year-old where you are read a story. As I say, for some people this has worked, and for some it has not. Going back to Tolstoy himself, in an earlier biography, he's talking about how ridiculous to waste his time inventing stories when life was surging about him on all sides, dragging him into the current. Writing stories was a game for children, not a fit occupation for a man. Man had been created to work with his hands, help his neighbor, and teach the young. Down with pure art and social art, too. said, I shall write no more fiction. It is shameful when you think of it. People are weeping, dying, marrying, and I should sit down and write books telling how she loved him. It's shameful. And he goes on, this is extraordinary, I think, from a man of his stature. But we know that he did come and go on every side of every problem. It was filled with contradictions, but he's talking about the masses who, as you know, he tried fearfully to educate, or had fantasies about educating the masses, which did not turn out very well. He says, I became convinced, I remember the marvelous moment, or a piece of music such as Beethoven's Ninth Symphony is less worthy of admiration than Vanka's song or the lament of the Volga boatman. and that we do not like Pushkin and Beethoven because they are expressions of absolute beauty, but because they flatter our hideous, overstimulated sensitivities and our weakness. And further on, why are the beauty of the sun, the beauty of the human face, the beauty of a folk song, the beauty of an act of love or self-denial intelligible to all without any special training? Tolstoy saw as a blinding proof that art is defended by the aesthetes was nonsense in the following arithmetical observation. We are thousands and they are millions. The artist must obey the law of the greatest number, write what they want, or not write at all if they do not want anything. After all, one could live perfectly well without writing. The people whose very dirt was sacred were sufficient unto themselves. They needed no one to satisfy their aspirations for work, pleasure, thought, and creativity. And the travails of writing. Definitively, I'm convinced that it is worthless. The style is too loose, it's his own work. And there are too few ideas to make up for the shallowness of the rest. It is an odd thing, but reading bad books helps me to detect my own faults more than good ones. Good books reduce me to despair. Well, I could rattle on from Tolstoy, who I'm much more fond of Dostoevsky. But these observations on writing and on the ups and downs, the way one goes at it with enthusiasm, the way one despairs, I think are all very well put. As I say, his whole notion of writing as edifying, as teaching. He will say, our vocation is to edify mankind. This principle granted, these men should then have asked themselves one fundamental question: what are we, and what are we to teach? Instead of which their method was to avoid the issue by affirming that one need not know anything in order to teach, since artists and poets teach unconsciously. He's very anti-intellectual, interestingly enough. He has applauded from his very first word by every writer of his time. He denounced their literary conniving. For him, the only things worthy of respect in Russia were the aristocracy and the people. He was a member of the former and was attracted to the latter. Through the veins of a noble coursed the entire history of the country, and through those of a mujik, all the wisdom of the earth. Between these two true beings, a third had insinuated itself, a new and entirely artificial, useless, and untrustworthy creature, the intellectual. The intellectual was not nourished on experience, but on books. He had claimed the right to instruct his fellows, and he had never fought or plowed a field. Most of the time, his pen produced nothing but falsehood. One more moment here. I've been fascinated by, you never know, you write something thinking that you have made it clear, and then, as I say here, this woman comes up with me saying the law is nothing but a source of evil. The story of Turgenev in writing Fathers and Sons, which is, I think, one of the best novels in any Western language. And if you recall, in it, the two main characters, one is the young, very gentle, poetic, as it were, young man who is represents old Russia in sentimentality, the icons and the censer, the incense and so forth, that whole world of Mother Russia. And the other character is Bazarov, who is the young nihilist. This is the late 19th century, who is overwhelmed by the whole scientific method that nothing is true unless it can be tested and felt for its reality, tangible reality. And their collision. And curiously enough, His portrait of Bazarov, of the nihilist, he was entirely sympathetic with that new Russia, with young Russia, with this dawning kind of new world, as against the old-fashioned, tired, sentimental picture of the old Russia. But when the book came out, he'd done such a good job that all of the young people turned against him, thought that Bazarov was a cruel picture and an indictment of their new embrace of science and reality, as it were, and that the touching, sympathetic character was Arkady, the young poet, and of course old Russia, whom he really was fed up with by his time, all rushed forward to embrace him and say, "Oh, what a wonderful book you've written." And he stopped writing for some time after that. And I think you can see why. And I think I will stop talking. I think I may have overstayed my time here anyway. But that's pretty much what's been on my mind. Thank you. Thank you. Feel like they say about Tolstoy when he, what's the great book? War and Peace, yes. When it had finally gone to the printers after endless editing and rewriting and so forth. And it finally was off to the printers, and Tolstoy woke up in the middle of the night and said, "My God, I left out the yacht race." And maybe I left out the yacht race, but I'll let you know if it comes to me. Thank you.